We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, chapter 24, entitled Chanting the Song, sung by Lord Shiva, text 29. Sadharmanista satajanma vipuman
Sadharmanista satajanma vipuman
Virinchatame tirtata param hima
Virinchatame tirtata param hima
Avyakritam bhagavato ta vaishnavam Param yataham vibhuda kalajit svadharmanista. One who is situated in his own dharma or occupation. Satajanmavi, for 100 births. Puma, a living entity. Virinchatam, the post of Lord Brahma. Iti, gets. Tata, thereafter. Param, above. He, certainly. Ma, attains me. Avyakritam,
without deviation.
Bhagavataha, unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Atta, therefore, Vaishnavam, a pure devotee of the Lord. Padam, post. Yata, as. Aham, I. Vubudaha, demigods. Kala atyaye, after an annihilation of the material world. A person who executes his occupational duties properly for 100 births becomes qualified to occupy the post of Brahma. And if he becomes more qualified, he can approach Lord Shiva. A person who is directly surrendered to Lord Krishna or Vishnu in unalloyed devotional service is immediately promoted to the spiritual planets. Lord Shiva and other demigods attain these planets after the destruction of this material world. Purport. This verse gives an idea of the highest perfection of the evolutionary process as described by the Vaishnav poet Jayadev Goswami. Pralaya payodi jale dritavan asivedam. Let us begin tracing the evolutionary process from the point of devastation, pralaya, when the whole universe is filled with water. At that time there are many fishes and other aquatics, and from these aquatics evolve creepers, trees, etc. From these insects and reptiles evolve, and from them birds, beasts, and then human beings, and finally civilized human beings. Now the civilized human being is at a junction where he can make further evolutionary progress in spiritual life. Here it is said, svadharmanista, that when a living entity comes to a civilized form of life, there must be svadharma, social division, according to one's work and qualification. Thus, it is indicated in Bhagavad Gita 4.30, Chaturvarya Mara Maya Shishtam Vimukarna Vibhagasa. According to the three modes of material nature, the work ascribed to them, the four divisions of human society were created by me. In civilized human society, there must be divisions of Brahma, of Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Sudra, and everyone must properly execute his occupational duty in accordance with his division. Here it is described, svadharmanista, that it doesn't matter whether one is a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or a Sudra. If one sticks to his position and properly executes his particular duty, he is considered a civilized human being. Otherwise, he's no better than an animal. It is also mentioned here that whoever executes his occupational duty, Swadharma, for 100 births, for instance, if a Brahmana continues to act as a Brahmana, becomes eligible for promotion to Brahmaloka, the planet where Lord Brahma lives. There's also a planet called Shivaloka, or Sada Shivaloka, which is situated in a marginal position between the spiritual and material worlds. If after being situated in Brahmaloka, one becomes more qualified, he's promoted to Sada Shivaloka. Similarly, when one becomes even more qualified, he can attain the Vaikuntha Lokas. The Vaikuntha Lokas is a target for everyone, even the demigods, and they can be attained by a devotee who has no desire for material benefit. As indicated in Bhagavad Gita 8.16, one does not escape material miseries, even if he's elevated to Brahmaloka. Brahma Bhuvanaloka Punaravartina Juna. Similarly, one is not very safe, even if he's promoted to Shivaloka, because the planet of Shivaloka is marginal. However, if one attains Vaikuntha Loka, he attains the highest perfection of life and the end of the evolutionary process. Mamupecheta Kuntiya Punarjanmana Vijayate. In other words, it is confirmed herein that a person in human society who has developed consciousness must take to Krishna consciousness in order to be promoted to Vaikuntha Loka or Krishna Loka immediately after leaving the body. Chapter Deyam Punarjanma Naiti Mameti Sojuna, Bhagavad Gita 4:9. A devotee who is fully in Krishna consciousness, who is not attracted by any other loka or planet, including Brahma Loka and Siva Loka, is immediately transferred to Krishna Loka, Mam Iti. That is the highest perfection of life and is the perfection of the evolutionary process. So it is interesting how Srila Prabhupada says here, let us begin tracing the evolutionary process from the point of devastation, pralaya, when the whole universe is filled with water. At that time there are many fishes and other aquatics, and from these aquatics evolve creepers and trees. From these, insects, reptiles evolve, and from them birds, beasts, and then human beings, and finally civilized human beings. So here we find an evolution description, not a creation description. On other occasions we read how at the very beginning of the universe coming into being, that the living beings, they are again reinstated in where they were before. It's said that at the end of the dissolution, that's the full annihilation, they enter into the body of Mahavishnu, stay there, and then again come out. Now, the pralaya, or the inundation, doesn't just happen at the time, at the end of the day of Brahma, but it happens at the end of every Manvantara. It is said that one Manvantara is a period of 91 yugas, Mahayugas, cycles of 91 Mahayugas. And then there is a 71. Check that one. Anyway, 71 I think it is. So then we can see on the at the end of a life of Manu, there is an inundation. So that's a pralaya, not a pralaya. Pralaya prayuri jale hitavan asivedo. So Prabhupada quotes Jayadev Goswami and about the pralaya, the flood, and then begins to describe how various living beings evolve there. So, from such statements, we think that one doesn't exclude the other. Right? That it is possible that there is creation, and that it is possible that there is evolution also. But maybe not in a Darwinian way, right? Where like the one species transforms into another. We don't see that. But so it is a little bewildering when we read this kind of descriptions of Srila Prabhupada, because he speaks out against monkeys turning into men. He clearly said, we have monkeys, we have men. So if previously monkeys were turning into men, then why are monkeys not turning into men today? Which is a relevant question. So Prabhupada is questioning this kind of element of evolution, survival of the fittest, and then very slowly over time, one species would change into another species. I said, no, we don't see that. We see how maybe within one species, right, there are adjustments. But, you know, we see how a particular species may adjust. But we don't see how one species turns into another. Rather, the species are already there. they are there from the beginning of the creation, from the time of Lord Brahma, according to Bhagavatam. So this statement is a little bit standing on its own, and what to do with it exactly, where Prabhupada is hinting at an evolution, it's a little unclear, to be honest. I wouldn't know what to make of it, because it's a little contradictory to other things. But all right. There, see the way it says here? At that time, there are many fishes and other aquatics, and from these aquatics evolve creepers and trees. That sounds complete. Although, how would through evolution from aquatics trees and creepers evolve? It's all a little complicated to understand. So, this I just leave it as it is without making much of it, because it seems to contradict other statements of Prabhupada in the Bhagavatam and so on. And it's just a little obscure. That can happen, that there is some, because it's fast scripture, fast information. So there can be something obscure. Anyway, that is just a side point, because it's not so important. More important is actually how the living being can elevate himself, and that is really what we're interested in, and especially in the human form of life. How the human form of life gives us the opportunity to elevate oneself. Now it says, if one perfectly follows one's prescribed duty according to Varna and Ashram for 100 births, one can attain the position of Lord Brahma. Now, to reverse that, it's like the position of Lord Brahma is rarely attained. There's not too many who attain that. So from that we can understand there's not too many who are living 100 births as a Brahmana. So as we find in scriptures, Abrahma Bhuvana Loka Punaravati. No, that's not the one, sorry. Tasyaidahitu Prayati to Kovido Talapyate Yad Brahmanam Upayada. It is said that the living beings, they go upwards in the universe and downwards again. It also says that Mano Ratina Sati Davato Bahi. One may have all good qualities, one may be a Brahmana, but if one is not finding shelter at the feet of Krishna, one is not fixed. One is still riding in the chariot of the mind. You see, the chariot of the mind is very powerful, the manorat. So the charity of the mind can take us here and there and everywhere. But because life is not just always predictable. There are surprises, there are unexpected opportunities, and suddenly the mind thinks, oh, that would be so nice. And we follow, we go for it. And therefore, sometimes we take unexpected turns. That can happen. But one who is fixed at the feet of Krishna in devotional service will just stay there. Just like Srila Bhaktisiddhanta is explaining that the etymological meaning of the word guru is heavy. And heavy because he cannot be moved from Krishna's lotus feet. He remains there, fixed at Krishna's feet. And that is really the test. But because many are not so fixed at Krishna's feet yet, or a little light, they are fixed at Krishna's feet, but when there's a strong wind coming from the three modes of material nature, a strong opportunity to enjoy something material, then blown away, like a boat, blown by the wind, it says in the Bhagavad Gita. Even a man who is of learning, a man who is a devotee, he is sometimes blown away by the power of the wind. So how can we avoid this? By anchoring ourselves more and more in devotional service. It is simply that, by filling our life
with devotional service. And the more devotional service is there, that devotional service becomes our anchor. Then the waves of the three modes of material nature will not affect us anymore. Like Srila Prabhupada is describing the jnana plavena, or the boat of transcendental knowledge. So we are in the boat of transcendental knowledge, but that boat of transcendental knowledge is still moving on the waves of material nature. We are with that boat of transcendental knowledge crossing Sansara Sagar, the ocean of repeated birth and death, the ocean of nescience. And on that ocean, there are waves of the three modes of material nature. So although we are in spiritual life, we are rocked by the waves of material nature. So we are safe in the process of devotional service, but we feel the influence of the waves of material nature that come and they shake us. But an experienced captain, right, even on a rocky boat, he stands on deck. He is not like getting seasick, he's not wobbly, he's just, you know, it looks like his feet are glued to the ship, you know, nothing can shock him. But someone who's never been at sea and the first time on a boat, right, and the rocking of the boat and seasickness comes and you turn green, you know, and feel like terrible and very weak, and that is the difficulty. So in the same way in spiritual life, we may in the beginning, when the three modes of material nature come with their waves, we may feel weak. We may not feel strong at all. And we wonder, how can I stay on this ship? But it takes some time to get used to it. It is said if you're on a ship, I'm a Dutchman and we know about ships, and I used to have a yacht and used to sail. So if you want to avoid seasickness, what you have to do, you have to eat something solid. You eat something solid and you eat like a big solid meal, not a light meal. You eat like a serious meal. And then the stomach sits like a rock, you know, it doesn't move at all. And then the waves won't affect. No seasickness. So like this, in Krishna consciousness, when we feel weak due to the rocking of the most material nature, take a solid meal of prasada, lots of. That will help us to cope with this seasickness of like the waves of material nature. So, in other words, take shelter. Take shelter of devotional service. Yes, we are young, right? And there's still so many opportunities and you don't want to miss out. You know, I mean, it's your life. You know, your life. Oh, yes. Your opportunity, you know, to be happy. Oh, yes. You don't want to miss out on your life. And now what? All right. But keep it within Dharma. Because that is the path through the material world of avoiding suffering. Otherwise, we go the path of suffering. When we get involved with the three modes of material nature, we get involved with suffering. That is inevitably so. Even if it looks like enjoyment, it doesn't come by itself, you see. That object of enjoyment, which will bring you some enjoyment, will also bring you suffering, because both of these elements are included in it, sukh or dukh. At the time of the marriage, all one can see is the enjoyable side. At the time of the divorce, all one can see is the suffering side. Like that. It says it starts with courting and it ends in court. Now that is maybe a little bit gloomy picture. Right? I admit it is. There are good marriages. But even then, you know, in a good marriage, both of these elements are there. The happiness and the suffering. Both. And with everything it is like that. You know, you think, I want to have children. Right? Then you have children and then you have the biggest headache. Right? But you really want them And of course you love them, but they bring both happiness and distress. That's how it is, because the little angels are not just angels. They may be little, but they're not just little angels. Nobody is an angel. Of course she is. I know. I could see it straight away.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, some people are very, very nice. But okay, you know, no one is perfect. We all have our weaknesses and so on. So what to do? Happiness and distress are always there in anything material. And that we have to understand. But when the enjoyment looks so good, then we don't see the suffering at all. And we are in love. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta gave a description, and he said, like, you meet this new person and you think this person is amazing, has just an ocean of qualities, an ocean of wonderful qualities. After a while, you get to know the person and you realize it's not an ocean, just a pond. You walk around the borders and you couldn't care to ever see that person again. Falling in love and falling out of love, kind of thing. An interesting description. Very poetic. First you see an ocean, and then you know the boundaries of the ocean, and the excitement is gone. Of course, but then maybe you go on to another level, a level of like camaraderie and partnership, where you say, yes, we know that this partnership is not the answer to everything, but, you know, we know that Krishna is the ultimate goal in life, but we need some support, we need to share, we need to be with someone who is also doing it, so that we don't have to do it alone. Doing it together will give us strength. And that is the positive side of marriage, where that camaraderie, that support, that is there. And that will in the sannyas ashram, one has to be a self-starter, right? No one's gonna tell you, right? Everyone is just saying, oh, you are so wonderful, and this, that, and meanwhile, you know, you have to be, you're a human being, and you have to be a self-starter. You have to do it, right? No one. So, whereas, you know, a married man, his wife will tell him, you know, go do something. And the other way around, it is like that. Husband and wife, they stimulate each other. So the Grihastha ashram is certainly positive in that way for Krishna consciousness. Providing one takes proper shelter of principles of Dharma. So that is nice. It is ultimately a material arrangement, and like I said, nothing in the material world is only about happiness. There's always duality, happiness and distress in anything. So, therefore the sannyasi becomes renounced. He becomes renounced. He says that, why bother if there's happiness and distress anyway? And the happiness is temporary, distress also temporary, so why bother with all these things? Anyway, but then the Grihastha ashram, the sannyas ashram is a little bit isolated from everyday life. And people see a sannyasi like, you know, devotees appreciate a sannyasi, but at the same time a sannyasi is sort of like so otherworldly, you know, so somebody like just in his own realm, not like someone you can just easily relate to. Therefore some people feel it's easier, you know, to just relate to. Sometimes it's easier to relate to a Grihastha who is in the world and, you know, just the person of the world. So everything has two sides that we can see. And everything always has two sides, advantage, disadvantage, because it's the material world. And And we have to somehow or other therefore create a balance in every situation. And I'm taking the old-fashioned scales, you know. And we have to make sure that there is more weight on the Krishna side. Doesn't matter where you are in life. Doesn't matter who you are in life. But somehow or other, if we put more weight on the Krishna side, some may say, we don't know much about Krishna. Okay, on the spiritual side, but put more weight there. If we do that, then the situation becomes favorable. And if we don't, it's not favorable. Not favorable at all. That is the test of any situation. That is found in Bhagavatam Chatusloki. In the Chatusloki it says, Riteritam yat pratyet in a pratyet chatmani tadvityat atmano mayam yato tama yato basa. Which means that the value of something is measured of how much it is favorable for the service of Krishna. And that's simply how we measure things in the world. Is it favorable for Krishna? Oh, very good. Not so favorable for Krishna? Useless. Simply like that. Yeah? And in this way, we measure in the world with that transcendental yardstick of what is favorable for Krishna. And so, everything is clear for a Vaishnava. A Vaishnava, therefore, doesn't need to be confused. Oh, what to do, what not to do, what to do, what not to do. Difficult to decide. No, very easy. Just look at it. Is it favorable for Krishna? Good. Not favorable for Krishna? Bad. So good and bad become crystal clear in every situation. No more confusion. No more from how do I know what is right, what is wrong. It's so difficult to decide. Like in my country, a little bit ahead of Australia, and I'm not proud of this, but in my country they have something called euthanasia. Yeah? Huh? And I know that in Australia there's a debate, or and that some states are also now opening up to it. And in my country it's legal. Yeah? Completely legal. So when someone is terminally ill, then they give that person the right to take some medicine, and to go asleep. Yeah? Like that. And they allow this. And it happens. It happens. And it's like a very difficult situation. I've known some cases. Like, I've known some people. So it's for me not just something that I read about in a magazine or on a website or something. No, I actually know some people who were in this situation and who decided to do it. And there was nothing I could do to stop it. And it was very shocking, in a way. But let me explain the story. The person had cancer. The intestines were riddled with cancer, and it was like just, the doctors were hoping they could do something. They opened it up, they looked at it and said, oh my God, closed it and said, no, too far gone, nothing we can do, it's worse than we thought. So meanwhile, they had, they made a colostomy, a false exit, right? The entire intestinal tract was no longer used. The person had a lot of pain. But no problem, they gave a lot of morphine. The person couldn't eat. No problem, they were intravenously feeding this person. So, all hooked up and kept alive by all kinds of tubes and so on, and therefore not dying of the disease. Right? And the pain of the disease being controlled by heavy doses of morphine and still painful. Still painful and all the time drugged out. So no wonder that person said at one point, what's the point of this? I don't want to go on anymore. Now, and when you say, take me off all these machines, you know, that's not allowed. That's not allowed. No, no. No, 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 no. You know, no. That's not allowed. Sorry. It's against the law. So the only thing that is then, so it's funny,
It's not allowed to become to take the people off this artificial life support, but it is allowed to take some nice medicine, and which puts you to sleep within 10 minutes. Right? It's a drink, you know, nice drink. It's got a flavor also. It's tasty. It's a tasty drink, very tasty, and it only lasts 10 minutes. Hmm? 10 minutes, and then you go to sleep, you know? And it's so nice, you know, and everyone sits there and says, oh yes, you know, it's like, it's just such a peaceful way to leave and to die, you know? Yeah, I mean, really, like, you know, he didn't suffer at all, no, really. You know, he just went to sleep. It was actually a really nice way to go. A materialist will say. And it's like, we look at this like, what in the world is going on here? But you can understand, though, after you heard my explanation, how a person would decide for it, because they just get caught in this whole hospital system with all the tubes and this and that. And it's just like, really, after I saw it from nearby, I suddenly could understand. Well, I can understand why someone does it. Not that I say it's okay. Yeah. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying do it. I'm saying don't do it, because it's not authorized. But they say that Vaishnavas, traditionally, if they were terminally ill, in Indian culture, and in Vedic culture, and in our Vaishnava culture, there was the right to stop eating when one is terminally ill, and just then, and drinking, and let it go. Well, if you stop eating and drinking, you won't live very long, right? Then you're gone. So, and I know a case of someone who did that, and there was a devotee doctor, and he said, it's suicide. This is suicide. Yeah? So how complicated. But Prabhupada authorized that. And the Vedic culture authorized that. What to do? Because it is a very difficult situation. When one is going through so much suffering at the end of life, and one is terminally ill, what to do? But we cannot take poison to go to sleep, because then we won't live in a normal state of consciousness. And we live in a poisoned state of consciousness that is not regular. Anyway, so just to take a topic from the newspapers, or from, you know, euthanasia. What do we think about it? And you have to know about it, about, you know, it's going on around you right now, and what is your opinion about it? Yeah? So we can see right and wrong are sometimes difficult to determine. Right? Now we have our yardstick, whatever is favorable for devotional service, and we measure everything, but even then sometimes we can't figure it out, like euthanasia. It's a difficult thing. Scratch, scratch. Is it all right? Is it not all right? You know, is it all right if children are deformed in the womb, and they can see it nowadays with a scan, to have an abortion? Or should we let such people take birth and suffer? All kinds of ethical questions are being raised that are bewildering the mind of so many people. And there are debates about it, some in favor, some against. So we have our Krishna consciousness, and we measure everything by Krishna. And then we have acharyas, right? And who gives a statement, like our Prabhupada gives a statement about something, all right, that gives us some more clarity. And then there may be still borderline cases where we are bewildered. But Prabhupada said one thing: when in doubt, don't. You know? When in doubt, don't. Like, I have a question to you, and it's like, you know, it's a funny question, right? Since you are all, you know, vegetarians and peace-loving people, so my question is a funny question. But don't mind that I'm asking it, since I'm sort of now asking all these complicated things, right? So let us say there is a disaster
there is a plane and it crashes, and it crashes in the ocean somewhere in a remote area, but it's floating. But still, you know, somehow or other, you're the only survivor. You're the only survivor. And, yeah, you just make it off the plane and you get to this island. And you're on the island, but what are you going to eat? You brought something with you from the plane, but what are you going to eat? No. There's like nothing to eat, you know? Nothing to eat. Not even plants, you know? Now what are you going to do? Are you going to eat fish? Will you start fishing at that stage? What to do? Or will you just say, no, I depend on Krishna, and if Krishna will send me something to eat, I will have something to eat, or I will starve, and I will just starve like that, you know, whatever Krishna wants, live or die, I depend on Krishna. So what to do? If you put this out into discussion amongst the forum of devotees, and I've done it before, questions like this, you get very divided opinions. Very interesting. Some devotees say, well, yeah, what to do? I'll have the fish, you know. Okay, others go, oh, no way, never. Never. So, okay, I'll leave it up to you to decide what you're going to do. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm the never type. No way. I'm not going to take anything like that. Because I'm not so attached to this life anyway, you know. I don't have to survive at any cost. Why would I live longer at the cost of my of remaining fixed at the lotus feet of Krishna? Why compromise it to prolong my life? What's the benefit, you know, of a life anyway in the material world? And you prolong it, it's like a couple of times my life was prolonged. Yeah, I was some 21 years ago, I was shot, I was almost dead. Yeah? And 21 years went, and I got saved, you know. Then 21 years went by, and I almost died again. Yeah? And say, gosh, you know, that went quick, those 21 years, actually. So why make such a fuss, you know, about it? So personally, I would not compromise, but others would take the fish. Yeah? No, what about that? You know, is that bogus? Is that Maya? Well, I can tell you something about that. In the scriptures, there is a reference to apadharma. Apadharma is the dharma or the religious duties one follows, and where one deviates from the regular path. Apadharma. And apadharma is sometimes followed in case of emergency. And we have the example of the sage Vishwamrita. And there was nothing to eat. And the sage Vishwamrita finally ate the flesh cooked by a chandala. A chandala, he ate dog flesh to stay alive. He did it. In the Vedic times, a sage, Vishwamrita, he did it. And it is right there. He followed apadharma. So I hope that I've now caused enough confusion in your mind. And that from this lecture you walk away just totally lost. And you just think like, what to do now? Right? What to do? And with that, I want to open up the floor for any questions to see if you have any, or any discussion, and see what you say. Thank you very much. Yes?
I'm just thinking, one devotee, I'm not sure where it was, but it's a question I asked to Srila Prabhupada, exactly that. If I'm lost in Antarctica and all I can eat was fish, should I eat that fish? Maharaj, it's like, eat the fish.
Prabhupada said. Okay, I don't know that particular, but particular instruction. But there is a reference that I can tell you in the... I'll try and find that one, you know. I'm going to Google it. And database it, and whatever. I'm going to find it. But there is a reference, you know, in Satsarupa Maharaj's Diary of the 70s, where he says that Prabhupada explains that apadharma may be followed with the permission of the spiritual master. Right? Then it may be followed. Yeah? So, but one must have the permission of the spiritual master. I wouldn't... I prefer the rely on Krishna approach myself. But if someone wants to take the fish, then okay, it's your risk. That fish.
Maharaj, I think it's a bit of a hypothetical question too, because people may take a line one way or the other, but we are actually in that situation. What they would do is hard to predict.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that too, Maharaj. Okay, you say you wouldn't eat the fish, you know.
Yeah.
And Krishna, but when you're in that situation,
yeah,
you're starving to death, and there's all these lovely little fish swimming around.
Yeah.
And you could just pick them up.
Yeah. Hey, you could do it.
What could you do?
I wouldn't do it. For me, it's not hypothetical. But I'm a sannyasi. I think for a sannyasi, anyway. So, I think a sannyasi should really... I've thought about all kinds of hypothetical things, you know. I'm a sannyasi, right? And I've thought, what if a bomb drops and, you know, the big bomb finally went off and there are no survivors and I'm somehow or other a survivor, right? And then somewhere I roam on the surface of the earth and then there's a lady and she's also a survivor. And then she tells me that now we are Adam and Eve, and that we, you know, have the duty, the duty to restore mankind. And I'll say to her, sorry, Mataji, I'm a sannyasi. I've thought about it. Now, it may be hypothetical, but still, I'm kind of quite determined that that's what I'll do. Yes.
What is the line for Himsa and Ahimsa?
Yeah.
And
you tell me, you tell us. Because that is the question. You've just translated the issue into Sanskrit language, and that sounds impressive, but you haven't indicated where the line is. So where is the line?
Suppose we all are eating rice.
We're eating rice.
We are eating rice and all other things. While doing that, the farmer is killing so many worms and creatures and everything. Finally, he is getting the product. We are cooked and we are eating. That means part of that sin is also passing to us?
It is if you're just a vegetarian. But if you're offering it to Krishna, it says that yagya sistati no sante muchante sarva kilvishai, that you must take yagya sista, remnants of yagya. Otherwise, you're eating only sin. So even vegetarian eats only sin, because you have explained it nicely. Yes. But if you take yagya sista, then remnants of sacrifice, then you are saved from the reaction. So who are you going to offer the fish to? Krishna? Or offer to the demigods? Adi has a solution.
Yes, as a sannyasi, you may be on that island.
Yeah.
You don't eat the fish, you die.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you eat the fish, you live.
You live and I can preach.
Then the boat, yeah, exactly. The boat comes along.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get on the boat.
I get saved. Saved. I saved the whole world. Yeah, I'm not so merciful. I'm not going to eat the fish. If Krishna wants, you know, then he said he can send the boat a little earlier also.
Maharaj, in the Mahabharata, in the Aranyaparva, Vanaparva, Markandeya Rishi explained it to Krishna. Is asked Markandeya Rishi explain this dharma to Yudhishthira. Then he start narrating this about Himsa and Ahimsa, the borderline. Even though if we are on our path, whatever we are doing, the creatures and everything will be dying. In our sound vibrations also, so many small creatures will die.
Absolutely. And that's why we have this, these five duties that the householder has, five yajnas he has to do to counteract the sins of killing, when he lights the fire, when he grinds spices, like this. But like I said, Bhagavad Gita is the transcendental portion of the Mahabharata, which speaks about serving Krishna. And Bhagavad Gita says you can overcome that problem by taking yajna-sistha, whatever is offered to Krishna. No karma, even. And those living beings, they get benefits. So the worms that in the process of growing the vegetable, they get benefit because the vegetable is offered to Krishna. So everyone gets you don't get reactions. Even the worms that died, they get benefited. So no one loses when yajna-sistha is involved, says the Gita.
Maharaj, it reminds me of a book which I read long time back. There were a few people who were lost in the sea in a boat.
Yeah.
And it was monks, and only one person survived. And he ate the flesh of other dead bodies.
Right.
They were living at the time.
Yeah.
So,
That happens also. I didn't come to cannibalism, but I was going to come to that. Thank you for bringing that up.
Somebody eating the flesh of a dead human being, and that's what he did.
Yeah, yeah.
And when he was interviewed, he was later saved, and he was interviewed, and he said, I don't know why I did it.
Yeah.
But that's what the thing that came to my mind, let me do it.
Yeah, yeah. When you come to that point, then obviously the options are very clear. When we sit here in the chair or comfortably in the temple, we don't think like that. But when you get really hungry and you're really starving, you suddenly start to look at your neighbor in a different way. Look who is fat and skinny. Who has some flesh on him. Like, he doesn't look very tasty. But Ali and Srinananda.
In that instant, Bhad, what I would do...
Clap in the hands three times. Ooh. And then what would happen?
You know the story in the past time in that where I think Mahaprabhu asked Srivastava, what will you do if you don't get food? He clapped three times. He said, if I don't receive the first day, I'll keep fasting. The second day, if I don't receive anything, I'll keep fasting. Third day, when I won't receive anything, I'll keep fasting. On the fourth day, I'll touch the water and say, Ganga Chai Munai Chai, and dive into it.
Just dive in the Ganga. And if there's dive in water. He makes it into Ganga water with a mantra. There's a little platter. Yeah. So we are more on the side of voting against doing it and relying on others. But others, so whatever. I guess everyone's in his own boat.
On balance.
Yeah. In this matter. Right? Yeah, that's why I'm not saying this, like, this is something the whole world should follow, everyone should follow in such a case. I'm not going to hammer over that. But personally, I feel like, it's like, you know, I'm not so important. Right? The world will go on without me. The Sankirtan movement will continue without me. I shouldn't compromise. I think it's better if I don't compromise my standards for anything. If I just keep it like when a sannyasi keeps his standard like a line in stone, when it's like a line in stone, nothing can change it.
That's the resolve, the sannyasi's resolve should be like that.
Yeah.
And that was Raghunath Das, the line in stone. Your turn.
If your spiritual master is giving you the order to go preach in this particular country, and you end up on the island before getting there?
And you end up on the what?
On that island before getting
on
to
island
the country.
Before getting to the country, yeah.
Would you still not eat the fish?
Yeah, still not eat the fish. I have the order to preach. My spiritual master did give me the order to preach. But, you know, when I'm dead, I'm dead, you know? When my time comes, it comes. If an accident happens on the way, what can you do? Then I can't go. Yeah? You know, accidents can happen any time, you know? Car can roll over, then. Didn't make it to the program. Sorry.
To preserve your consciousness, it's just as important to preserve the body. And if you start maintaining yourself on such diet, then it's going to kill your consciousness.
Huh? It what?
It will kill your consciousness.
Kill your consciousness, that's the word.
So it's just as important to maintain your consciousness.
Yeah. Now, as you can see, you know, we're not gonna resolve this issue, but we're just stirring up some things today just to sort of get some thoughts going, and we share some thoughts, and well, we hope it will be a hypothetical situation and that we never get into it and all these things, but we've read the stories and also real testimonies in the news about people in the history of the world who survived on human flesh or other flesh and all these things. Yeah.
A real life question. Sometimes doctor prescribe fish oil capsules.
Yeah.
So should they be taken or?
Well, we have Srila Prabhupada's childhood situation where the doctor prescribed a chicken broth, and the parents, although they were vegetarians and they never had done anything like that, said, well, if that's like the only thing that will save him, then what can we do? The doctor had someone who prepared it and brought it to the house. And they tried to give it to the child, and the child started to vomit. So it never worked. So then they never gave it. No. So we should try to avoid, but you know, such things. We wouldn't openly take fish oil. But then, you know, you have capsules that have gelatin. Yeah, and one may say, oh, well, we can avoid that also. And I know one sannyasi who was carefully exchanging the capsules for vegetarian capsules, right? And, you know, he bought empty vegetarian capsules, opened up the capsules, put it all in there, and that was very sincere and very nice. But when you're in the hospital and you're just lying there and you're really far gone, right, then sometimes you cannot really do such a thing. You can't go get some capsules. You just have to take what's there. So sometimes we just have to take what's there. But if we have a control over it, then better avoid it. But everything in this world is like, you know, it's just contaminated somehow. So complicated. But some strictness in this regard cannot harm. No? It's like we only save ourselves bad reactions if we are strict. So, oh well, you know, it's okay. All right, you say it's okay, are you sure? In the end it may not be, you may get karma for it. You can't be fanatic, okay, you can't be fanatic. And then at the end of life, Yamaraj pulls you up. Said, so, we can't be fanatic, can we? I can't be fanatic either, can I? And then what? So, we don't know, ultimately, what's going to happen. So, better safe than sorry. I think myself. You know, I mean, that's why I'm a little inclined to its strictness. It's so, well, I don't know. What if I get a little liberal and it's not appreciated later on? Better take no risk. Anyway, but if you're starving, really starving, what you gonna do? That's up to you. Anupadharma does exist. There are precedents in the Vedic tradition for emergency.
So I've not given you a solution, I've given you a problem.
But I have shown what I favor. Yes,
I
agree.
Say an Eskimo.
Say?
Eskimo.
Eskimo, yeah.
Yeah. Born in the north of Alaska.
Yeah.
No vegetation.
No vegetation.
All they eat is simply whale blood.
Yeah.
Is that a sinful activity for them?
It is a sinful activity. It is. And it's the continuation of previous life sinful activities. See, in the previous life they were so engrossed immediately that in this life they've been placed into a situation where they have only meat. And now the question may be raised, why does the Eskimo stay there? Why does he just go south? Or, you know, or why does he come down from to a warmer region? He chooses to stay there. So, at one point he makes a choice. You know, it's not that he has no choice, he has a choice. He can just come and live in Australia, join the temple in Canada, you know, and say, I'm an Eskimo. Bhakti Eskimo. Bhakti Eski will probably become, you know, Australia. Eski, you know. Yes. Well, there's different reasons. You know, everyone gets happiness and distress. You can't avoid that, even when you're a devotee and you live a life. For Krishna, still the material world has suffering built in, basically. The body will give you suffering, other people will give you suffering, nature will give you suffering. You can't avoid that. And sometimes it says that Krishna will put his devotees through extraordinary tests. And why does he do so? Like the Pandavas, they were going through extreme tests. They were in a forest with cannibals and all these kind of problems, right? Many, many problems. Murder attacks on their lives. It was just too much, the Pandavas. But why? And there's even a discussion in the Bhagavatam between Yudhisthira and Narada. And Yudhisthira says, well, if this is what Krishna does to his devotees, I wonder what he does to his enemies. There is a verse like this. And that's really interesting. So also the devotees go through a lot of trouble. But because of that, at the end, when the devotees have passed all the tests, then they become glorious. And everyone will say, this is amazing. Look at the Pandavas. Look at Kunti Devi. What they had to go through, and no matter what they went through, they always stayed Krishna conscious. And in this way, and that is why they are glorified. That is why they are the Pandavas, and we all worship the Pandavas. And that is why Kunti Devi is like giving instructions in the Bhagavatam and acting like a guru. Though it's ladies generally don't, but she is like extraordinary. Extraordinary. So sometimes Krishna puts his devotees to test, to glorify them. Just like Prabhupada, you know? Nothing could discourage him. Nothing. His Bhagavad Gita, he's almost finished it, it gets stolen. He starts again. Most of us just say, oh God, you know, give up. Prabhupada would not give up. And so much difficulty. And that is his glory. Like that. Krishna gives sometimes difficulties to devotees to glorify them. Okay, enough of all of this. We thank you very much.